Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. Women are generally told that if they have a breast cancer diagnosis, they should steer clear of estrogen. But today, I'm having a conversation with the lead investigator of a new study in which women with a breast ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, were given a month's worth of hormone therapy prior to treatment to see the impact it would have on developing cells. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Swati Kulkarni is a professor of surgery at Northwestern University. In addition to practicing clinical medicine, Dr. Kulkarni has dedicated her career to research and has published extensively on the relationship between obesity and breast cancer risk, tamoxifen resistance, and today's topic, identifying medications to treat and prevent breast cancer. Welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Okay. I remember when you first told me about this study, that was 2017, right?
That's right. Yeah.
It's yeah. Time flies. You know, for eight years, I've been waiting for the results. Not just me, but a lot of other academic menopause experts were aware that this study was going on. And I get asked about it all the time. And I always just say, I don't know. The results aren't out. And finally they are. But, you know, for starters, 8 years seems like forever when we're waiting for results. But in the world of research, that's not unusual, right?
No, it's not. And actually, I started working on this project in 2015. So it's been a decade of me working on this project. And initially, it took a couple years just to write the protocol and also just to get the funding. I mean, that was a big issue with this is the initial study was funded in 2015. And then we lost our funding source. And then I had to find another funding source. So that's how I ended up going to the NIH, and they funded it in 2017. And then the trial was originally funded for 5 years. But then, of course, we had COVID in between, you know, this time. Between 2020 and 2021, we struggled a bit with recruitment because, as we'll talk about a little bit later, one of the ways that we find DCIS, which is what we're going to talk about today, is with screening mammogram. And women were advised not to get
their mammograms.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of a delay for a couple of years. But once the pandemic passed, we were able to get back on track and finish recruitment. So we finished recruitment last year.
Yeah. But this isn't unusual. You know, the funding alone, I think people don't realize that you can't do this stuff without money. And funding sometimes is really tricky to get, even with a really good, well-designed study. Okay, let's start with this. All the women in this study had been diagnosed with DCIS, but had not been treated yet. So exactly what is DCIS?
DCIS stands for ductal carcinoma in situ, or, you know, we also call it non-invasive cancer, or we call it stage zero cancer. Generally, it's diagnosed on screening mammogram, can't feel it, don't have any symptoms from it, presents usually with calcifications. That's the classic way that we see DCIS, we find DCIS on mammography. And patients usually have to undergo a biopsy to make that diagnosis. And what they're finding is that there are abnormal cells within the duct of the milk ducts, but the cells have not yet escaped out of the milk ducts.
So is this a cancer or is it a precancer?
Yeah. So again, you know, so I think that it depends on who you ask and how you define cancer. That's how I think about it, because, you know, strictly speaking, a cancer is something that has the ability to travel to other places in the body or metastasize, but DCIS does not have that ability. It's inside the duct. Again, we define it as, you know, non-invasive cancer, stage zero cancer, but I think the important thing to remember about the name DCIS is that it was first described before we really understood the biology of BCIS. So it was described based on what it looked like under the microscope. So without really knowing, well, how does this behave in the body? You know, is it something that's harmful for you? Is it something that is, you know, a risk factor? Is it something that's not harmful for you? So, I mean, in terms of how to answer that, I would say that definitely it's something that can lead to cancer. Patients who have DCIS have a much higher risk of getting invasive cancer, which is what is more worrisome to patients.
Let's talk about how it does behave in the body. First of all, how often does it actually progress to invasive cancer, which is the problem? And what's the timeline?
So there have been some studies that were done several years ago that looked at women who were diagnosed with invasive breast cancer, and then they looked backwards to see if they had had prior breast biopsies. And they found a certain group of women who had been misdiagnosed with benign breast biopsies, but really had DCIS. And they pulled those patients out and they studied those patients to see, it was a retrospective study, so looking backwards, but they looked to see how many of those patients, how long it took for those patients to develop DCIS.
But did they all develop?
No. So what we know from this is that 25 to 50% of patients who are diagnosed with DCIS will eventually develop invasive breast cancer if they are not treated. And the time period for that is very long. So, you know, so women get a diagnosis of DCIS and they think it's, oh my goodness, I have to have surgery right away because the DCIS is going to progress to cancer. But in those studies, the average was 9 years. From diagnosis of DCIS to developing invasive breast cancer.
So if a woman does get treated for DCIS, and we'll talk about that treatment in a second, how many of them go on to develop invasive cancer in spite of the treatment?
After treatment? So it depends. So again, DCIS is not like one type of disease. Like there's, you know, it's very, we use the word heterogeneous. There's, you know, there's low grade DCIS, there's high grade DCIS, you know, so it's not one disease. So for patients who, let's say, have a mastectomy, the chance of them developing invasive cancer or developing a recurrence is 1 to 2%, but you're trading off this very big surgery. And then for women who have a lumpectomy.
So what is the standard treatment for DCIS?
So the standard treatment for DCIS is still surgery to remove the area with normal tissue around it. And then depending on what we find at the time of surgery, some patients may get additional treatment with radiation or they also may get recommended to take an anti-estrogen medication.
Yeah. But I think the important part is that it needs to be surgically removed. This is not normally treated with medication.
Right. That's correct.
And I think I want to make it clear that you are a breast surgeon.
That's right.
You are actually doing the surgery. You're not just talking about it.
Exactly.
So one of the ways to know what's going on in breast tissue is by tracking a protein known as Ki-67. Yes. And this is something that was used in the study. So before we get to the study itself, can you explain what Ki-67 is and how it's used in both the clinical world and also in research?
Sure. So Ki-67, it's a protein that we find in cells, and it's specifically found in cells that are actively dividing. So if cells are growing and dividing, they tend to have a lot of Ki-67. If cells are just kind of sitting around, they're not expressing Ki-67. So it tells us that the cell is actively growing. And so how we use it a couple of ways in the clinic. So one, you can get it, the way we measured it, it's a score or a percentage, I should say. So from 0 to 100. So generally, we know that women who have tumors that have a high Ki-67. So this is an invasive cancer. So we actually do not use Ki-67 in DCIS. It's not for standard of care. This is for invasive cancer. So women who have a high Ki-67, you know, we're 60-70% of their cells have a high Ki-67. We generally think that those patients will have a better response to chemotherapy. So it might help a clinician think, oh, this patient will respond better to chemotherapy. The other way we use it in breast cancer, again, in invasive breast cancer, to contrast from DCIS, is it can sometimes be used to figure out if patients are responding to treatment, what we call neoadjuvant treatment, treatment before surgery. And an example of this is a patient who's taking what's called an aromatase inhibitor or an anti-estrogen medication before surgery. Patients can get started on that medication. And then a couple of weeks later, you can do a biopsy and test the Ki-67 to see if the Ki-67 is decreasing so that the patient is responding to that treatment. Mm-hmm. And if they are, they can continue on with the treatment that they're on, the anti-estrogen medication. If they're not, maybe you need to change your treatment course. Maybe that patient will go on to surgery or chemotherapy, but it's a way to help us figure out if somebody's responding in a more rapid way than just waiting to see if the tumor continues to grow, because that takes a long time to see if a tumor is going to grow on imaging.
Just to be clear, is K67 something that's measured in the blood, something in the tumor itself, or both?
It's measured in the tumor itself. So if you have a sample of tumor, you can make a piece of the tumor on the slide, and then you can stain it specifically for the protein Ki-67.
So it requires more tissue, requires another biopsy.
Yes. If you want to test the response 2 or 3 weeks later, you have to take a needle biopsy, another biopsy. Yeah.
And if I'm hearing you correctly, this is something that is measured generally in someone who has an invasive cancer. It is not measured in someone who has DCIS. Yet in this study, research world, you did measure that. That's a really important point, because a lot of things that are done in research are not standard of care in the real world.
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct. So we measured Ki-67 or Ki-67 for our research study because, again, it was a relatively quick way to determine if our intervention is working. Again, rather than as you were saying, to see if the DCIS becomes an invasive cancer, you have to wait years and years and years and years. So Ki-67 is relatively sensitive and changes relatively quickly. So that's why it's a good tool in research.
So speaking of interventions, the drug that was used in this study, the intervention, was a specific type of hormone therapy. And anyone who's listened to me is well aware that if someone chooses to take systemic estrogen to treat hot flashes, prevent osteoporosis and other menopause symptoms, that they need to take a progestogen or a progestogen substitute to prevent the lining of the uterus from developing a precancer or cancer. And one of the most innovative progestogen substitutes is a selective estrogen receptor modulator, commonly called a SERM. And SERMs in general, tamoxifen is one, Clomid is one. SERMs either stimulate estrogen receptors or block estrogen receptors, depending on what tissue it's being used in. And the SERM that was used in this study was bezodoxifen. And bezodoxifen does a great job of blocking estrogen receptors in the uterine lining to prevent any abnormal cells from developing. But in the United States, you can't get bezodoxifen by itself. You can other places, but not in the U.S. And the only way that you can get bezodoxifen is combined with conjugated estrogen in a product that's currently FDA approved to treat hot flashes and prevent osteoporosis. And the name of that product is Duavie, which I've spoken about many times, most recently in my episode on bone health with Dr. Risa Kagan. So my question to you is, what led you to study the impact of conjugated estrogen with bezodoxifen in the first place?
So I have always been, as a clinician, I've taken care of women who are at higher risk of breast cancer for 21 years now. So, if they have, let's just say they have we have high-risk lesions like atypical ductal hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ or atypical lobular hyperplasia. So all of these lesions, women would, we see, you know, as a surgeon, these patients come in to see us, they undergo an excisional biopsy, and then they, you know, they have this diagnosis. And then it's, what do you do with these women? Because they are, by nature of having this diagnosis, they have about a 1-2% risk per year of developing invasive breast cancer in the future. And what we've had available for, you know, during it, what we've had available really is tamoxifen for premenopausal women and aromatase inhibitors for postmenopausal women. But a lot of women don't really like to take these things, you know, because they have side effects. They have hot flashes, you know, they can have, you know, for aromatase inhibitors, it can impact their bone density, they can have joint aches. But a healthy woman, you know, who's very active, they don't want to feel badly for something, for a disease they don't have yet or may never get. And so this has always been in the back of my mind of, it's a little bit frustrating because, you know, we know these medications can prevent breast cancer because the studies in invasive breast cancer always showed a significant reduction in contralateral or breast cancer in the other breast when they took, you know, tamoxifen and an aromatase inhibitor. So we know that it can prevent breast cancer. But again, women just didn't want to really take it. So when I was presented with this information about conjugated estrogens and vasodoxifene, I was really excited about it because it's like, oh, you know, this medication may prevent breast cancer and patients won't feel bad.
What was known before your study about the impact of vasodoxifene in breast tissue? Because just to be clear, this drug, Duovay, vasodoxifene conjugated estrogen, has been on the market for a long time, and it says in big black letters on the label, do not take if you are at risk of breast cancer. Do not take if you have breast cancer. And we all know that that's about class labeling. It's not about that it ever showed that. But there was information even prior to release that it can have a positive impact on breast cells. So talk about that for a second, what you knew leading up to this.
Absolutely. So there were several, what we call preclinical studies in mice and actually in monkeys, in postmenopausal monkeys, that showed that this combination significantly reduced Ki67, you know, expression in these models. So we had that information. And in the, you know, there were a whole bunch of studies that were done to get FDA approval for Duovy, for bone health and for hot flashes. So they had retrospective data that showed that there was no increase in breast cancer in the CEBZA group. So we had all of this information. And also, you know, there was also the information from the Women's Health Initiative, right? You know, so that now we have 20-year plus data that shows that the conjugated estrogens didn't increase breast cancer.
Well, decreased it by 21%
in the estrogen only group. Decreased it. So we had this information. So there was quite a bit of information that made me feel very comfortable about doing a study in these women and also just, you know, I really hopeful that it would, you know, we really felt that based on this data that we would have a positive study, you know. So
the other piece that I read in the paper that I wasn't aware of is that vasodoxifene doesn't just reduce the activity of the cells in the duct, but it also increases activity that's an anti-tumor activity in the breast. Is that correct?
Oh, so you know, when we think about progressing from non-invasive to invasive breast cancer, you know, so the breast is made up of ductal tissue and then the tissue that surrounds it, like the connective tissue, we call it the stroma. So it's made up of, we call them fibroblasts, fat cells, you know, so all these other types of cells. And so there's a hypothesis or theory that it's not just what's going on in the ducts, it's also what's going on in this tissue surrounding the milk ducts and how the cells in the ducts and the stromal cells interact with each other. So that's the part of the study we actually haven't, we're still analyzing the data. So we did actually look at that in our study, but we had the most information for the study for the cells in the duct. So that was that. That's why that was our primary aim for the study, was to look at changes in the cells in the duct. Okay. But we will also report out what we find in the stroma.
So there's more data to come, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
A lot more data. All right. So let's talk about the study. Walk us through it. Who'd you recruit? How'd you recruit them? How many women were in it? What were the groups that you studied? Just walk through the design of this study.
So the study was, so it was a multi-center trial. We call it a phase two. It was randomized, placebo controlled, and blinded. So the investigators didn't know, the patients didn't know who was getting what drug. We had the study open at 10 sites. Northwestern was the lead site. It was open all over the country. We approached almost 1,700 women. We got 171 to consent to the study and ultimately 141 enrolled. And that was our goal. And I would just want to say for research studies, this is pretty typical. So usually you get 10% of the patients that you approach. So that wasn't terribly surprising.
Yeah. I mean, when we talked about the timeline of the study, that's the other piece of it that people don't realize, is it's not just about designing the study and getting the funding. It's also about getting women to sign up for this, which takes a lot of effort. I remember I was encouraging a lot of women to enroll, and I don't even know if any of them actually participated, because it's just such a large pool to get to that end pool.
Yeah. So then, you know, once we met the women generally at their initial appointment, when they came in with their diagnosis of DCIS, that's when we would approach them. And then they would, you know, if they were interested in the study, they would be randomized to the CEBZA group, or we had a placebo arm. And then we asked them to take the medication for 3 to 5 weeks before surgery. We had a little bit of a range so that, you know, there was some flexibility and, you know, to flexibility for the operating room schedule.
Yeah. I have a question about that also before we go on, is that, you know, when we talk about women who agreed to the study, obviously this takes a lot of counseling and information to get them on board. Do you have any idea, were the women that ultimately said yes, were these women who were already taking hormone therapy and had more of a comfort level with it? Were these women that were more symptomatic as far as hot flashes, so that they were more, you know, amenable to the idea of taking something that was also going to help their menopause symptoms? How did that play out in recruitment?
So, you know, we could not include women who were currently on SERMs, you know, who are already on tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors for prevention, or on any type of hormone and any type of estrogen or progesterone. So those were excluded from the study. Thank you for reminding me to bring that up, you know, because that could impact our baseline measurements. Those women could not take it. We couldn't really say only women with hot flashes could participate, because it was, again, such a challenge to get patients in general. So we couldn't really... couldn't do that.
But you didn't exclude people with hot flashes.
No, we couldn't exclude patients who did not have hot flashes.
Yeah, because that actually was one of the issues with the WHI, is that they excluded people with hot flashes, which is why they ended up with older people and really a different cohort of people. And it also means that when we talk about it being double blinded, didn't that throw off the double blinded part? Because if a woman stopped having her hot flashes, I'm sure the light bulb went off and she said, aha, you know, I'm getting the study drug.
Right. So anyway, so we didn't exclude people for not having hot flashes. We took all comers with DCIS. That was just, you know, so that's what we had to do.
Yeah. Okay. So I interrupted you. So you gave them the drug for 3 to 5 weeks, and then what?
Then they had surgery, just standard of care surgery, whatever they had planned to have. And then we just followed them for a couple of weeks, you know, until after their post-op visit, to make sure they didn't have any, you know, any side effects or any other, you know, issues. And then they came off study. So patients were really on study maybe for 1 to 2 months.
Yeah. So it really didn't delay their treatment.
No, it didn't.
Right. Okay. So we're on pins and needles. What were the results?
So it was really exciting. I mean, the results were highly significant. So of the 141 patients who enrolled in the study, 117 ended up being included. You know, patients drop out for various reasons. You know, sometimes they get overwhelmed with the study, you know, so we had 117 patients who were compliant, so took all of the medication, that or took 80% of the medication and had surgery. in that group, there, we, you know, when we do surgery, sometimes all the DCIS is gone, you know, so there was a small area of DCIS. So there wasn't tissue available for analysis.
You mean that the initial biopsy got rid of all the DCIS?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that happened, I would say, 13 patients. So yeah, about 10% of patients didn't have any DCIS. And you just can't predict that, right? You know, we had a size criteria. We wanted 1 centimeter of DCIS on imaging, but the core biopsy sometimes just removes all of it. And so we had 94 patients that ultimately had tissue available for this Ki-67 analysis.
What happened to women who got the study drug?
So I think the big takeaway is that in the women who took the conjugated estrogens and vasodoxifene, their Ki-67 was much lower, was significantly lower than the group that took the placebo medication. That's the big takeaway from the study.
And that's the best way to track tumor proliferation, the activity of these cells. So that's a big deal.
Yes.
Were you surprised or did you expect that?
Well, that's what we proposed, a decrease in our initial proposal was about 5%. So it's very close.
Yeah. I mean, that is very, very impressive.
Yeah.
You know, one of the questions I have is, as a researcher, you can get your hands on things that are not necessarily available to the public. So you could have gotten some basodoxifen by itself, but you chose to use basodoxifen combined with conjugated estrogen.
Yeah.
So, you know, why? Why?
Mostly for the reasons that I talked about before. I think that the combination of the drug, I think it's a really unique medication, you know, where you're, you know, what, yes, basodoxifene is a SERM by itself. It had, you know, similar to tamoxifen. It can, you know, can reduce cell growth. But it has side effects. Basodoxifene by itself can have hot flashes with that and other symptoms, like other SERMs. And so the combination of the conjugated estrogens and the basodoxifene to me was what was appealing about this.
I think the other thing that's appealing about it is because you got such great results, and it's too soon to apply this clinically, we're going to talk about that. But at a time when it does become something, hopefully, that we're recommending to women, we already have a product that's FDA approved, so that you don't have to reinvent the wheel to get women to take advantage of this. So there's that part. The other thing I want to talk about is a lot of women have this idea that estradiol, you know, so-called bioidentical estrogen, is better and safer, and that it's going to be, you know, a decreased chance that it's going to cause breast cancer over conjugated estrogen, which of course was the old Premarin. And that's not true, correct?
I'm not a, you know, not a gynecologist, but what I'll say is that, you know, conjugated estrogens are very different from estradiol and bioidentical estrogens, because conjugated estrogens, actually, it's not just one type of estrogen. It's a lot of different types of estrogen compounds. And that conjugated estrogens actually have, you know, some of them are more active, you know, are more stimulatory to the breast. Some of them are less. So in many ways, I think we think of conjugated estrogens, you know, some of them have like SERM-like properties, you know, so they can, like, again, some of them stimulate and some of them inhibit the breast tissue. So I think they're
not the same. And I think the other thing is that I think it's important to point out is we have very, very good data on conjugated estrogens from the WHI. We do not have that kind of data from estradiol because it's all observational. And I've talked about the difference between that a lot. And so while I'm not implying that estradiol increases the risk of cancer, we certainly don't have the same kind of data that we do with conjugated estrogen as far as it being protective or decreasing cancer. So I think, you know, it's really an important message to get out there that all estrogens are not created equal and that we can't extrapolate these results to someone who's taking a different kind of estrogen. We'd have to have more studies to prove that.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you this. I mean, you're a breast surgeon, and breast surgeons are at the top of the list when it comes to blaming breast cancer on estrogen and telling patients that estrogen is out of the question if they have a breast cancer diagnosis, no matter how long ago they had that breast cancer diagnosis. And clearly you're comfortable with this because you know the science, you were on board, but this was a multi-center study. So how difficult was it to get other oncologists to agree to participate?
Actually, that wasn't very hard to get other physicians to participate. I think that because it was a short intervention, and I mostly approached surgeons because it's a window of opportunity study. Most surgeons understand that it's a short intervention. So it's just like 3 to 5 weeks. And so that wasn't an issue to get other surgeons to get on board with the study.
I mean, they knew it wasn't going to cause any harm, even if it didn't work in that period of time. A lot of women are taking estrogen anyway, and that doesn't seem to speed up the time frame. Yeah. So, all right. But okay, it's one thing to get the surgeons on board. Was this a tough sell to patients?
Yes, it was a really tough sell to patients. We were struggling with how to get patients to participate. So during the pandemic, when we weren't able to recruit, we did some focus groups, and patients, there were really two big buckets of patients that didn't want to participate. One was the bucket that felt that all estrogens are bad, or all hormones are bad. And what the remarkable thing was for me, looking backwards, is that I didn't really think about this, because it was easier to sell to surgeons that it was a short intervention, nothing was likely to happen. But so many patients told us that even if they took estrogens for a month or 2 weeks, that would be enough for them to get breast cancer. So there was this lack of understanding about that. So that was a big group of patients.
I mean, let's face it, the first thing that happens from the breast surgeons is when a woman is diagnosed with DCIS or an invasive cancer, they are told, and you must go off your estrogen this minute. And they do, they say that. So they get this idea that breast cancer is caused by estrogen and it's going to increase the speed of growth. They get it reinforced by the breast surgeon. So I can't blame those women for being nervous about taking estrogen with a known diagnosis.
That's true. And then the other reason that women didn't want to participate in the study is this idea of how quickly DCIS progresses, So they thought, oh my goodness, I cannot wait. So at many institutions, the time from diagnosis to surgery can be a month, which is how we designed this, 3 to 5 week intervention. It can be a month. It can be 6 weeks. It can be 3 weeks. So we didn't perceive it as a delay in surgery. We tried to design it that way, but patients perceived it as a delay in surgery. Oh my goodness, I can't have surgery tomorrow or next week. And so this was the other big group of patients that were hesitant to participate. So, after we got the results of those focus groups, we did try to, adjust our messaging. And I think it did help a little bit. But that particular paper talks about talks about some of the challenges we had in recruiting to this study.
Yeah, I remember that there was a change in the messaging because I was handing out your pamphlets to patients to get them to enroll. And there was a change at some point, and on your Facebook page and all of that. It's called the Promise Study, by the way, if anyone wants to read more about it. All right. So the other thing you looked at that we didn't talk about is you looked at quality of life in the participants and hot flashes and all of that. And the hot flash is a no-brainer. We know that people that were put on the estrogen basaldoxifen group, of course, their hot flashes went away. That was what it's there for. We know that. But you looked at quality of life. So why did you do that? And what did you find?
So I looked at quality of life because of what we know from other endocrine therapies, what we know from tamoxifen and what we know from aromatase inhibitors, that patients, they have side effects from these medications. And because of that, they're not compliant with the medication. And ultimately, many patients stop taking the medications for the side effects, or they don't even want to go on it because they're afraid of the side effects. So I thought that this was a really important part of the study, was to look at side effects. So we actually looked at two different, there are these patient-reported outcomes. We looked at two different measurements. One was called the BEST questionnaire, which looks at endocrine therapy symptoms, and the other one looks at menopausal symptoms. It's called the MenQol survey and its impact on quality of life. So we looked at the comparisons a couple different ways. So we looked at within arm differences. So within the within the CEBCA arm and within the placebo arm. And then we looked at the differences between the two arms for both groups. And so when we looked at it between the two groups, between CEBCA and placebo, we actually didn't find any differences in quality.
Okay. You know what? Explain that. That makes no sense to me, because we know that women that have bad hot flashes score really poorly on quality of life questionnaires. And yet you demonstrated that hot flashes were reduced in the study group, yet their quality of life didn't change. I was just like kind of scratching my head on that one.
So I think there are a couple reasons for that. I would say that the main reason for that is, you know, the intervention's relatively short, right? It's 3 to 5 weeks. Potentially to see a real change, they might need to be on the study for a little bit longer, and I think the other thing that is important about we touched on it earlier, is that we didn't enroll patients based on whether they had hot flashes or not. So there were a lot of patients who, and I don't have the exact numbers. That's something we're going to look at when we are planning to publish our paper. But I think we need to break down the group into those who had hot flashes when they started the study and those that didn't. But I think that's the main reason that we don't really see a difference, is because we had a group of patients that some had hot flashes and some didn't. If they didn't have hot flashes in the beginning, their quality of life is probably not going to change.
But the important thing is it didn't make it worse. And in other studies, when we look at other interventions like aromatase inhibitors or tamoxifen, did you see the quality of life score go down that quickly within a month of starting the drug?
In those studies, for tamoxifen and aromatase, most of those studies look at patients for, so that's the other thing. Most of those report like data for 6 months.
It's kind of hard to compare then say, I mean, not to be nitpicky about this, intervention wasn't long enough, maybe their quality of life didn't go down because you just didn't watch them long enough, or maybe their quality of life didn't get better because you didn't watch them long enough.
Yeah. I think that's one of the things about that. But nonetheless, we did see that patients, it wasn't statistically significant, which means, you know, the differences weren't so great. But we did see that women in the CEBCA group, both of our surveys, they had fewer hot flashes overall.
Okay,
enough difference to say it was by chance. I think, you know, or not by chance, I should say.
One thing we've kind of glossed over is that this was an abstract. It wasn't the full study that was published, and that's going to come. But since this was an abstract, and I've published a lot about abstracts, so I understand the limitations you were facing regarding space, a lot is not included. So you mentioned one thing earlier that you studied but wasn't included in the abstract. What other pieces of information do you expect to have at the time when you publish the full paper?
So one, you know, we talked about the tissue around the milk ducts, the stroma. So that's a big, you know, area that we haven't fully examined. We also looked at something called RNA sequencing, so which looks at gene expression. So it's looking at a little deeper into the changes we see in the tissue.
And I think it's important that while this was a very short study, the goal ultimately, of course, would be to potentially use this intervention for a much longer period of time. Which brings me to my next set of questions. You know, the National Cancer Institute funded the study, the NCI, and the NCI is part of the NIH, which our current anti-science government has taken a sledgehammer to. So has this study been defunded? Were you planning on continuing it? Tell me what's going on as far as that goes.
So no, the study funding ended last year, so it was not impacted by these recent, freezing of grants and things like that. So it wasn't impacted by what's going on currently. With respect to doing additional research on this, I would love to do additional research. One of the challenges is to get study drug, you know, from the company. And without that, we can't really do any additional study.
I do want to mention, I have no financial relationship with this drug, but it seems to me that they would be all over this. This is reassuring for women. And this isn't just about preventing progression to invasive cancer. This is about potentially preventing cancer in women who don't have cancer or DCIS, but maybe are at increased risk or just worried about it. And then, of course, we've got the big group, the women that are at very high risk because of a genetic mutation, such as a BRCA mutation or PALB mutation. And it seems to me that this could potentially be an incredible intervention for women who have either a high risk of osteoporosis or terrible hot flashes, that this might also prevent them from developing breast cancer. Am I overstating this, or do you think that
I agree. I mean, that is the potential of a medication, is it, you know, can help hot flashes, bone density, and potentially prevent breast cancer. That, you know, that's really one of the, I think that's one of the key things that's so exciting about the drug.
All right. So at Northwestern, there's a high risk clinic for women who do not have breast cancer, are at risk because of a genetic mutation or other reasons. So are you going to be passing these out like Pez in the high-risk clinic?
So right now, what I think you can say, again, relatively short intervention, we don't have long-term data following what happens to these patients in the future, relatively small study as well. I think you could say that patients, you know, who are, how I would say it is, if you are concerned about your risk of developing breast cancer, this drug is safe. So, you know, it adds to, I would like to say that patients, you know, if they're worried about the risk of breast cancer, this medication is probably not, you know, is not going to increase their risk of breast cancer.
So you're out to lunch with your neighbor.
Yeah.
And your neighbor says, I am dying from these hot flashes. Yeah. I just had a bone density and I have low bone mass, and my mother died after she had a hip fracture. I got to do something, but I'm worried about developing breast cancer. What are you going to tell?
I think, you know, I would say you should consider Duvy. So I would say that, you know, so one, again, we see women who have these high risk lesions, atypical ductal hyperplasia, you know, LCIS. I would say that if they have symptoms of menopause, I would say they could consider taking Duvy, because in the past we've said, you know, you have these high risk lesions, you shouldn't really be taking, hormone replacement therapy. So I would say that you could consider it if you are at elevated risk, but certainly not as a risk reducing agent, but just
right. Because we don't have that data yet. And I did a podcast episode with Dr. Jim Simon that we talked about personalized hormone therapy. And we really talked quite a bit about that. So I'll put the link to that in the program notes. So this is my other question, and I don't know the answer to this. Is anyone tracking women who have been taking Duvy in terms of, do they have a decreased risk of developing breast cancer over the general population? And this, of course, wouldn't be an interventional study. This would be an observational study, retrospective observational study. And then there was that period of time when Duvy wasn't available because of some issues that Pfizer had with packaging. So they had to take it off the market for a few years. But having said that, are you aware of anyone who is tracking data retrospectively for women on Duvy to see if it's protective more so than other hormone therapy?
No, I'm not aware of anyone doing that actively right now. I've heard some folks talk about wanting to do that, but not that's ongoing now.
Yeah, I mean, that would actually theoretically not be difficult to do, because that would essentially be a chart review,
right?
And other than that break, which is going to mess things up, but of course, even that takes a lot of money, a lot of money, and we know that these things are not getting funded right now. So what's next for you? What are you working on?
Oh, right now, I mean, I'm still working on analyzing. Even though this was, again, a relatively small study, there's a lot of data to analyze still. So I'm still working on analyzing a fair amount of data for this study, and then I have to write the manuscript for it. So that's really my primary goal right now.
Yeah, people don't realize that too when we talk about an abstract, which is relatively easy compared to the full paper to get it accepted, because people are always interested at conferences and in new data. And certainly that takes time and effort, and you've got to have the data. It's not the same as writing the full paper. And I'm on the review board for a couple of journals now, and it's tough, because even if it's a great study and it's well designed and it's amazing information, it's not unusual for papers to take a year to write, and then they go back for revisions again and again to make it to a journal, which is why, don't get me started, it makes me crazy when we hear the current administration and the people in charge of these things saying that these journals are biased or that they're putting misinformation in. I mean, in the world of misinformation, it's not the New England Journal of Medicine and Cancer and all the other big journals that we submit to that are putting out misinformation. These are highly, highly vetted journals that can't be biased, and that they have statistical analysis, and it is incredibly, incredibly difficult to get these things published, and takes enormous effort and time and expertise, real expertise. So there's that. In any case, I look forward to publication of the final paper, and I want to really thank you for taking time out of your insanely busy schedule to explain this study.
Thanks for having me.
So, just to recap, the purpose of this study was to determine if women with breast ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS, can safely take a specific formulation of hormone therapy, conjugated estrogens and vasodoxifen, and what the impact would be on DCIS and quality of life. Conjugated estrogens and vasodoxifen is currently available under the trade name Duovay and is FDA approved for the treatment of hot flashes and to prevent osteoporosis. And the reason conjugated estrogens and vasodoxifen was chosen to be used in this study is because in pre-release studies in animals, Duovay was shown to both reduce breast ductal proliferation and increase the activity of anti-tumor markers in breast tissue. So in this study, 117 women were randomized into two groups. Group one got 3 to 5 weeks of the hormone therapy, and their K167 decreased by 5.62. Group two received a placebo. So the conjugated estrogens and basodoxifen group had a significant decrease in the protein that's associated with breast cancer compared to the placebo group. And the conclusion of the researchers was that conjugated estrogens and basodoxifen has a protective effect on the duct epithelium and DCIS. So bottom line, while this study was too small and too brief to determine whether conjugated estrogens and basodoxifen is a potential treatment for DCIS to prevent progression to invasive cancer, the PROMISE study is very promising. This study provides reassurance that this specific hormone therapy does not fuel the tumor and may even prevent or cause regression of DCIS.